listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sound and culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
It's not that I don't feel it. It's not that I feel a lack of control in my daily life or in my environment, and that I need a space in which I can be in control. Maybe it's more about the description of the environment and the world. Being able to draw the flowers and the trees and places all inside my own head and then describe them and have it all come to life. It's rewarding.
I'm Nick Miser. I'm an anthropologist who studies tabletop role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons. I'm very interested in how it is that we experience imaginary worlds in general, and in tabletop role-playing games, that experience of imagined worlds is very focused, and so I've spent a lot of time doing field work and talking with people who have played tabletop role-playing games regularly. And what you just heard was an excerpt from an interview that I did with a dungeon master named Liz Larson in Denton, Texas. In reflecting on my field work in Denton, Texas, I continually find myself slipping through the cracks of that college town and into Nabonidus 4, which is an asteroid that formed the location of the three-session mini-campaign that Liz ran during my visit. The two worlds interpenetrate in my memory, as if the surface of Denton funneled downward towards Liz's apartment south of town, swirling my recollections around and depositing me on the slope of a lunar mountain, looking down over a forest of purple mushrooms. This is an attempt to capture my experiences in Denton as an ethnography of at least two dimensions. First, and primarily, it's about Liz's practices as a dungeon master and a performer. Second, and inseparably, it's a description of a sub-universe that Liz created with those gamers, and our collaborative experiences and co-creation of that place. I want to start by considering my experiences with Liz holistically, just attempting to communicate the ambiance of my experiences with her across multiple worlds as a unified whole. And then I'd like to try and bring together Liz's gaming practices into a semi-cohesive ontology of gaming, which I call chromomantic in the sense of communicating with and through color. Finally, I want to examine a particular instance of chromomancy as it occurred during the session of my field work with Liz.
Have this duality to me that enables me to like communicate a story in a way that I wouldn't be able to otherwise.
When I first met Lars, I didn't know he was a chromomancer. He came to the table at North Texas RPG Con with what I later learned is a characteristic softness, topped with thick-framed rectangular glasses. Ian, the cheerfully smirking redhead with the foresight to bring a flask of whiskey to the gaming table, sat next to me as our party gracefully stumbled our way through Lars's conjuration of the Tower of the Stargazer. When more by luck than skill we recovered the treasures of the tower and somehow escaped its crumbling destruction, Lars's eyes glimmered with excitement no less than ours. There was something enticing about the miniature world that he had conjured from the grim Scandinavian texts of Lamentations of the Flame Princess, a remix of basic D&D. Both Ian and I called for a repeat performance that afternoon. We talked a lot that first weekend, but I wasn't taking notes at the con that year, and all I remember besides running down the outside of the crumbling tower and later awakening an army of the undead is learning that the conservative Christianity of his childhood had kept him, like me, from D&D, and instead drove him to Middle-earth, which was considered a safer fantasy world. The next time I met Lars, he took my wife and I to an island of his own creation, just off the coast of an unexplored continent. Sitting in the house he and his wife came to hate because of its compartmentalized internal structure, My wife, Shauna, and I were welcomed as guests at their gaming table. This was the last time I saw Lars before his transition, and maybe it's partially because of this that I cannot visualize his face looking out from over the weird creatures that lovingly adorn his custom DM screen. If I picture Liz now, she's smiling, more with her eyes than her mouth, her short black hair matching the leather jacket that covers the Alice in Wonderland tattoo on her right shoulder, and the Errol Otis creature adorning the left. I'm imagining her at our first formal interview, and always seem to do so, sitting across from me at the wooden booth in Cool Beans, a local Denton pub. The smoke from our cigarettes lightens the deep browns of the all-wood interior in swirling light gray patterns as we discussed the session of the previous night, the session where I got my first real sense of her chromomancy. She explained the importance of the gaming space in shaping the imagined spaces to play. As I sat cross-legged next to the Larson's low coffee table made of some dark, glossy wood, the soundtrack to Fantastic Planet, or La Planète Sauvage, like Lévi-Strauss's La Pensée Sauvage, drifting around the room while Liz lounged back in her recliner and described the character's hovercraft journey through a forest of towering purple fungi, I knew what she meant. There was no hurry to that entire session. Like the music, we just languidly drifted through the world. Even though I didn't play that night, I felt a part of the session, going to this strange asteroid and seeing the events unfold with them. Somehow, even though we were inside and the darkened windows only reflected the room back at us, we still knew that we were three stories up, ensconced in the quiet safety of what Liz and Heather both called a treehouse. And it is a treehouse, even though it isn't decorated in an imitation of one. The light brown of the carpet and slightly deeper brown of the walls, the fairies perched on the walls in their picture frames, the warm glow of the lights. This serene treehouse contrasted with the environment of the asteroid that Liz brought into the living room through her descriptions, an environment bright and stark with its blue aquatic colonists, purple mushrooms, and dusty white lunar plains. Many of the scenes of their adventure hinged on the experience of color, strips of experience that I will attempt to reassemble through reflection. A transparent color, floating towards their craft as an orb filled with swirling matter, bristling with electric energy and deaf to their communications. The horror of transparent faces, thin strips of skin that refused to decently reflect the light and obscure the musculature and skeleton that lay beneath. Black reaching up from a blue planet, bringing chitinous blue insects, carapaces gleaming. Diseased darkness spreading vein-like or tree-like through a translucent blue membrane. Liz has told me that performance, whether on stage performing her psychedelic rock or leaning back in her recliner at the gaming table, is about taking the other participants and reality itself hostage and taking them to a world in her head, one that she usually first sees as the image of a landscape. To do this, she says, is to force the fictional reality inside my head onto the physical space and project it outward. She accomplishes this imposition, this taking hostage, through asking herself how the location should make us feel, then using color or song or choice diction, her words, to evoke that emotion in space. Color or song or choice diction. As she tells me this at Cool Beans, she maintains her quiet, even tone, letting her excitement come through her eyes and choice diction rather than through marked variations in volume, speed, or pitch. So different from her onstage persona, which I've never seen, but others have described to her as a mouse becoming a lion. But Liz is not mousy, at least not as people normally mean the word. The lion is still there in an assertiveness that comes through even when, at our second con together, you're straining to hear her voice over the commotion of other voices, bombastic by comparison, in a crowded room. In this DM persona, one in which she says she cultivates a judicial, otherworldly sense, is closer to the Liz I experienced in our interviews. Otherworldly and judicial. And mystic, too, because like many shamans, Liz uses her cross-cutting experiences of gender to mediate not only between the genders at the table, but between worlds. Although Liz does not identify as a shaman, she acknowledges and discusses some of the parallels with me in our conversations. Through both her psychedelic video art and her gaming, Liz creates what she has described as navigational tools and view screens into pocket dimensions. In some ways, my attempts to fix and describe my experiences of the pocket dimensions into which she has taken me hostage run counter to her preferred mode of experiencing them. In creating a piece of temporal art, one that is gone once it is finished, Liz feels a sense of freedom to live in the present, to be comfortable with the experience as it exists in that moment, rather than needing to polish it and make it perfect. She will spend hours alone in a locked room making visual art, manipulating electrical vibrations all the way from the circuits she built herself to the cathode ray tubes of her screen, producing colors that dance from the screen to her face until she turns off the screen, and mandala-like, they disappear, never to be experienced by anyone else. Gaming is more of a shared experience, of course, and although I've recorded, transcribed, described, and analyzed our game sessions, the experience itself has vanished as much as the colors on her screen.
The game of Dungeons & Dragons is about going into dungeons and killing monsters and taking their treasure. Experience points is all based on how much gold you pull out of the dungeon rather than how badass the monsters are you kill.
So it's a
resource management game instead of a tactics game. Your resources are your light sources and your weapons and how well you can utilize the different abilities and spells that you have, and how well you can kind of, as a player, puzzle your way through the situations and set up teamwork strategies with the other player. Mm-hmm.
Tabletop role-playing games began in the American Midwest, in the wake of the social upheavals of the 1960s, a time when the modern world seemed to be falling apart. To the east, the Bronx was burning in the midst of racial tensions, with over 30,000 fires between 1973 and 1977 in the South Bronx alone. Further east than that, the Vietnam War marched toward the fall of Saigon. Closer to home for Midwesterners, the 1973 oil crisis meant the dispelling of ideas about limitless energy supplies as residents waited in long lines for rationed gasoline. The following year would bring Nixon's resignation and the Boston police strike. It was in this context that a small group of Midwestern Americans developed a game organized around the collaborative generation of fantastic oral narratives, firmly grounded in an imaginary version of the pre-modern world. In citing this context, I don't mean to argue for a direct causal connection between the world events and the invention of role-playing games, only to draw attention to their angle of entry, the shape of the world in which they were produced. The more immediate backdrop for these games was the hobby wargaming culture of the 1960s, in which players simulated historical warfare using miniature figurines and sometimes complex rules for determining the outcome of conflicts. Through collaborations between Dave Arneson and Gary Gygax, they combined aspects of conflict simulation from wargaming with the flexibility and multiple win conditions of what were called N-player games, like diplomacy, where everyone has a different objective that they're trying to accomplish, and it's not necessarily one winner or loser. So they combined these things with the world-building fantasy tradition of authors like Robert E. Howard, Fritz Lieber, and J.R.R. Tolkien. They published the results of their collaboration in 1974 under the title Dungeons & Dragons, Rules for Fantastic Medieval War Games Campaigns Playable with Paper and Pencil and Miniature Figures. It's kind of a mouthful because no one had come up with this concept before. There was nothing for them to just call it a role-playing game. So, Rules for Fantastic Medieval War Games Campaigns Playable with Paper and Pencil and Miniature Figures was the best they could come up with at the time. By 2004, an estimated 20 million people had played D&D. Hundreds of other games have been created, and tabletop role-playing games had indelibly shaped the multi-billion dollar video game industry, influenced a generation of film and television writers, and dramatically changed the broader position of geeks within popular culture. As historian Michael Saylor has said, the habits of this minority have become those of the majority in the West. We are all geeks now. Even those who would never consider themselves as acolytes of Harry Potter or Luke Skywalker sojourn in imaginary worlds today, perhaps more than they realize. Developing better understandings of tabletop role-playing games offers more than insights into the quite sizable subculture of gamers. It illuminates changes to how people experience imaginary worlds across all of popular culture. So D&D is built on a paradoxical tension between free exercise of narrative imagination and complex rule-based limitations. In the game, each player takes on the role of a character, usually an adventurer, styled after the tropes of pulp fiction, like Conan the Barbarian. Game sessions tend to have between 4 and 10 players. Many attributes of the characters, like strength, intelligence, or skill with a weapon, are represented numerically, which provides a partial indicator of the likelihood of success in any given endeavor. So these numbers, combined with the outcome of dice rolls and rules guiding their interpretation, are used by a player who does not take on an individual character, but serves as a sort of referee. This referee, most commonly referred to as the Dungeon Master, or DM, not only adjudicates the outcome of characters' actions, but develops and describes the world in which those actions occur. And this is the role that Liz takes on most often when she plays.
Yeah, I tend to describe colors and sounds a lot. Obviously, when I mean, that's part of the one thing I focus on a lot as a DM. We had that in the session I ran at RPGCon. There was like a resonant chamber with the sword in it. It was bell-shaped.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a DM, you have to play to your strengths sometimes, too. If you're really good at describing harmonic ratios between frequencies, and you can work that into your description of the room in your game, then that makes it all the more stronger. It's important to me that I'm a really good DM, that I'm constantly improving. And this is just one of the things I want to do, I used to be very quiet kid. I was pretty much online all the time. Did not really spend a lot of people. So when I tried to DM, there would be that struggle, that communication and verbal communication struggle. And being a DM requires not just good verbal communication skills, but, you're conducting a meeting of people, basically. Keeping tabs on your own notes and keeping tabs on the mental state of everyone at the table and how those are all intersecting with the narrative. It's fun.
Do you kind of lose yourself in musical performance?
Yeah. I mean, if you saw me perform, you would not believe it was the same person. That's what everybody says. I'm very... very confrontational. The mouse that becomes the lion or something. But it's definitely, there is a role to it. There is the role of rock performer, front woman, that I like putting on. It's a core aspect of who I am, but isn't my everyday role. And the role of DM is very much a role. So in the same way that I want to be a good performer, I want to be a good DM. And so I go into a more authoritative, attention-focused mode when I'm DMing. DMing and performing are both sort of therapeutic aspects of my life.
Yeah, so do you feel like you come away, once you've stepped into that role for a span of time, and maybe backgrounded other parts of yourself, do you come away changed as a whole from doing that, do you think? Or how does that, when you say therapeutic? I don't know, I'm getting into like very difficult, reflective kind of things that are hard to think about, at least for me.
I mean, the way I would describe the experience of both DMing and performing is like a tension building up. Or like after the performance or after the game, you feel like an itch has been scratched that you may not have even known was there ahead of time. So it like releases something inside me in both cases that makes me more focused on my life as a whole, or more feel like more of a complete or happy person because of it. In much the same way that, church used to do.
And then, what about your role in performing? What's that role about for you?
It's about having, but it's about an audience, a feeling, a space that exists in my own head that I want to project outward into the world. I don't like it when anyone feels like they are a spectator when they're watching me perform. I want them to feel like, not that they're part of the performance, but more like they've been taken somewhere and are being held hostage there, being beaten up, in an auditory sense, you know, so it's like kidnapping someone into my own world, or kidnapping the real world with my fictional one.
Which could be a description of gaming, too. Yeah.
But, I mean, music always starts and ends with the idea of like, space has a mood, an atmosphere, and a geography, too. I can't make music without some sort of geographic image in my head, even if it becomes very abstract.
Well, I assume you must have been playing music growing up, if when you came here you started getting involved in the scene, or did you start later?
Not really. I didn't start playing music. I didn't play music at all growing up. I mean, I had friends that were in bands when I was like 17, so I, you know, thought, I'll buy a bass and join a punk band and see what that's like. Because I had just started seeing shows and concerts and was fascinated by the idea of like the band creates that sort of space.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what drew me to it originally. And, you know, at the time, late 90s, early 2000s, a lot of the music scene was focused on, you know, if you wear a costume on stage, your music is somehow not, your music isn't enhanced by that, but instead sort of nullified.
Mm-hmm.
Or the idea of creating an ambience or a space for the performance in the sense de-emphasizes the quality of music. And so, a lot of my early musical art was very much focused on attacking the whole thing. I guess, so I joined a bass, I played bass in for a while. And I had never thought about being, I was always the guy who was sitting back and played bass. And then like, after I moved up here, I met a couple kids from an art school in Plano, and they thought I looked weird or something, and they asked me to be the singer for their band. And that band was very soft. I mean, we didn't even have band practice. We just had like costume and stunt, you know, invention sessions, and would play. I mean, the whole goal of the band was to not stop playing until everyone had left the room. So it was very confrontational, but play in the most invasive sort of environments any possible, like coffee shops or like Mexican restaurants. And like, you know, if we were kicked out before we stopped playing, that was the goal of the band. That was the whole goal of the band. So once the music started developing as actual music, I had had lots of experience, you know, shrieking at people and scaring them in strange places.
Liz describes performance in general and gaming in particular as kidnapping reality. She speaks of this process from two primary angles. So from one angle, she's kidnapping reality, including anyone present with her at the performance, into a reality that exists in her head, which she also calls the fictional reality. To better understand the nature of the in-head reality and how it relates to the ontology of what Liz calls just reality, I find one of her phrasings of the process of kidnapping particularly helpful. She says, "It's like kidnapping someone into my own world, or kidnapping the real world with that fictional one." That was the first time Liz expressed that kidnapping concept to me, and I love it for the odd, almost ungrammatical usage of that word "with," to kidnap the real world with that fictional one. In trying to make sense of that "with," I think about an anthropologist named Ishii who claims that divine worlds are created through interactions and connections among various actors, including persons, things, and deities or spirits. So Ishii studies these rituals called Sumon rituals and finds that the things, the ritual objects in these rituals, act equally with the priests, and the divine world emerges through the co-actors' mutual self-poiesis, their mutual world creation. So as the priests and the Sumon objects interact, they remake themselves, and the divine world emerges through that process. And similarly, the imaginary world emerges through the interaction between Liz, the other players, and the imaginary objects, the imaginary world. But the ontology of Liz's fictional reality departs from Ishii's at an important point. Liz doesn't talk about creating the fictional reality, but about working with it to kidnap reality. The line between creation and discovery is maybe as arbitrary as the line between things and concepts.
D&D is very much, it's very much about discovering something that may have never even been there before and you discover it.
In some sense, the fictional reality already exists, so the problem is not how to create it, but how to tune into it and then kidnap reality with it. So having tuned in, so to speak, to the fictional reality, Liz then considers how to use ambiance to bring that reality out of her head so that the others at the table can enter into it. Rather than relying primarily on sensory data, this is an affective question.
The emotional context is important too. Sometimes I'll just think, how should this location that the players are in make them feel, or how should seeing this monster make them feel? And then I'll use color or sound or choice diction in order to try to convey that. Like when the giant blob like lit up really bright and I described like the shadows on everybody's faces, I wanted to invoke a sense of like a holy shit moment, you know, in a way other than just describing the thing getting really bright. And that was because I was concentrating more on what the characters are supposed to feel when this happens more than I was what is actually physically going on.
Liz describes these three elements of ambiance, color, song, and choice diction, as a way to convey the affect of the fictional reality out of her head and into the space around her. Color, as Taussig says, and Liz agrees, walks. Or to put it another way, as Taussig says, color is polymorphous magical substance. It affects all the senses, not just sight. It moves, it has depth and motion, just as a stream has depth and motion, and it connects such that it changes whatever it comes into contact with. Or is it the other way around, that in changing, it connects? Liz's gaming performances demonstrate that a color need not be seen with the eyes in order to connect and change things and people. Her description of color helped to convey it out of Nabonidus IV and into her living room. Color and song and choice diction, as experienced at Liz's table, are at times the same substance. In other words, when dealing with Nabonidus IV, the description of a thing like color, or the sounds associated with that color because they're playing in the background, are in fact the thing, are in fact the color. Even before she explained this to me, I experienced the music in her session as a medium of conveyance. In my notes on the music she played during our first session, before I had discussed any of this with Liz, I wrote, "It's not necessarily music that would exist in the fiction. It's music that serves some of the same purpose as Liz's descriptions. It's something in this world that serves to connect it with another. The music originated in our reality, in Liz's living room, but drifted freely and almost synesthetically in and out of Nabonidus IV, carrying some of the ambiance of that dusty landscape with it."
I mean, I don't usually really soundtrack out my games very much. You know, I'll throw something on. For this one, I think it was really important to get the mood across that I wanted. You know, we'll listen to everything from, you know, black metal to, you know, prog rock or just synth soundscapes or anything. This one, I wanted to create that very, you know, weird fantasy synthesizer land sort of feeling to it.
Yeah, for me, even just, you know, I wasn't even playing last night, but just kind of taking it all in, there were some moments where it just synergized so well. When they first started going out on the hex crawl and that kind of, you're describing them going through the mushroom forest and the music's going on in the background.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because it's not like that's the music that exists in that world. It's not the music that the Azure people would listen
right.
to. But it somehow, like, communicates that.
Well, yeah, and it's part of the
you know, pop culture subconscious from which this all arises anywhere in general. And that's, and I like being conscious of that, you know, and tying into that where I can. Like, if we're playing, like, a really gory limitations module, I'll put on, you know, Burzum or something evil sounding, you know, really foreboding and gloomy. But for this, you know, I think it worked. But, yeah, and you'll always find moments of synergy when you have music going along with something your brain wants to make the connection. Like, I mean, my work with video synthesizers is very much based on, you know, visualization of music is what a lot of people create art for. And people will think that the visuals are synced up to the music when they're not. Just because the brain wants to make the connection between what it's seeing and what it's hearing. So it sees two things that are divorced from each other. Even if they're in your head, even if it's imaginary, your brain is consciously trying to create a link between the sound you're hearing and the object you're imagining or seeing at the same time. And so if there's any way to make a link, it will.
Yeah.
To kidnap is to abduct, to lead away. And once Liz has led reality away into the fictional reality, she also seeks to hold it hostage for a few hours, she says, to bind it in place. But Liz also describes this process from the reverse angle and says, I play D&D to force the fictional reality in my head onto physical space and project it outward. So here the fictional reality takes the lead, with Liz kind of behind it and pushing it out into physical space. You have two motions, the kidnapping and the projection outward, and they're actually the same motion. To kidnap reality is to coerce it to receive the fiction as Liz forces it out. To kidnap reality into Nabonidus 4, this asteroid that Liz explored through our game sessions, is to bring Nabonidus 4 to Earth, and she does that through the skillful manipulation of ambiance, that color, song, and choice diction.
Okay. Kind of an odd day. The sunlight filters through the atmosphere in more of a mottled view than on the clearer days of the past. You know, it's like there's obviously some sort of hazy substance in patches along the top of the atmosphere, and it creates these sort of like refracted. It'd be like the shadows, but it's like there's spots of sparkly and there's spots of black on the moon dust around you. And the beams that kind of like pierce down through the heads of the mushroom. Hey, monkey. The beams of light that come down through the clouds through the mushrooms kind of like appear and disappear. It's a little very disorienting.
This invocation demonstrates Liz's use of ambiance to bring Nabonidus 4 into the living room where we were playing. The description is bracketed on either side with explicit cues. She starts by saying, it's an odd day, and then that progresses to disorienting at the end of the quote. Between those two points, Liz abducts reality using an ambiance composed primarily of patches of light and shadow diffused through hazy substance, or clouds, and the mushroom forest. Interestingly, Liz doesn't actually describe the mushrooms themselves, but just the light and atmosphere that surround them. But while Liz projected the journey into the living room, her son Loki entered the room, disrupting the abduction when he didn't want to leave. And Liz uses music, which by this point has transitioned into a staccato Morse code-like synth beat at just the right moment, to reopen that connection to the imagined world.
We'll bring him back to you in a minute. If he doesn't start being... Y'all go to your room. As long as he's being quiet, he can stay in here with us. We'll bring him back to you as soon as he starts being rowdy, okay? I'm sorry. I can't fix it right now. Okay. On musical cue, there
It appears you come through a section of the forest because you're exiting in a different way than you came out the other time you ventured into the sect. You pass by multiple clearings of the amber substance dripping down, and you find a way to barricade the stuff after a while, where you're going to have to find a way to have through or go around and lose another 4 hours.
Here, Liz conveys the world factually, with very little color or sensory data. It's like the view screen is still coming back into focus. But this factuality also serves to highlight the solidity of what would become the central focus of the incident, this barricade of amber substance. The substance drips from the mushroom trees like sap. And following this initial description, Billy, one of the players, seeks clarification, which prompts from Liz a more ambient conveyance of the entire scene, where she uses the ambiance to bring this reality into the physical space of our living room.
It's made out of this amber stuff?
Yes. This amber, it's like these have like stacked up so high that they like reach the tips of the giant mushroom trees that they're kind of like falling off of. And the ground is like really sticky all the way around. It's also because of the kind of blockage here, the light is much dimmer and darker. So you've got the headlights on in your cover car, and you can kind of see through along the forest floor. And you notice that the ground here, it seems to be free of all dust. It's like it's kind of like been hollowed out. So it's like volcanic rock. The mushroom stalks that grow here appear to be a little more wilted. You know, maybe they move a little bit more in the asteroid wind.
So interestingly, the stickiness of the ground that Liz mentions there is never actually bound to our reality. The players never echo it back, and it fades out of existence later when the characters actually step out of their vehicle. The changes to the light and the mushrooms, though, they act strongly in this conveyance. So here, light itself becomes dimmer and darker. These mushrooms are wilting and swaying in the newly discovered wind of the asteroid. Clearly, something haunts the place. Billy senses its presence, while the others just treat the barricade as a passive environmental feature.
Maybe we'll chop through it. You need a sample anyway.
Yeah, that's, it makes me nervous.
2 for 1.
Here, the barricade begins to act on the scene and change ever so slightly as the other players begin to shape it through their own imaginings and words. This barricade only exists through interactions with Liz and the other players. Their speech about the barricade is not a signifier of it, but the thing itself. So when the players change the description of the barricade itself changes, evolving over the course of this encounter in this game session. The first step in this particular evolution comes once the barricade is securely bound to our reality through its restatement by one player to another. This transition is important. The barricade no longer presents itself primarily to Liz and then secondarily to the other players through her description, but is accessible to the experience of all the players. When Heather, who had been pulled out of the frame by their son Loki, asked for clarification, the increased permanence of the now securely bound barricade results in a change of terminology.
Is the car having trouble? Oh, no.
Okay.
Is the car having trouble getting through any of it? Did you say it was sticky?
Do you want a paper? Here.
No, there's just a big wall of it.
Yeah.
There's a wall.
Stalagmites have reached stalactites, making giant towers and walls of amber drift, which are pulling on these mushrooms.
How sure are we that this wall is natural? That's what I'm concerned about. That it could be trying to break through some of this could be taken as attacking something.
Right.
A barricade suggests impermanence and improvisation, rightly so, because Liz improvised it into existence. But once bound by the other players, the barricade takes on permanence, and now it's called a wall. The newly formed wall immediately acts on the scene in new ways, with the suggestion of careful construction and permanence, suggesting to Billy that perhaps the thing is not naturally occurring. Ben introduces two new mutations in his binding. You heard the reference to stalactites making giant towers and ambergris. No reference to stalactites, towers, or ambergris had yet been made. The wall develops those characteristics as Ben speaks them. Ambergris, a evolution of the previous term that had been used, amber, highlights the ambiguity of the substance forming the wall. It is, of course, neither amber nor ambergris. It's some substance that only exists on Nabonidus IV. But because Ben's innovation goes unchallenged, it takes on aspects of both of those things and heightens the strangeness of the mushrooms and Nabonidus IV in general. Having firmly bound it to the space, the players can then interact with it apart from further description. So the wall, in turn, acts on the space by serving as a central anchor point for the entire scene. This anchoring becomes literal once the characters attach a rope, or actually, in Nabonidus IV, it's called an anti-graviton emitter, from their vehicle, to a withered stalk embedded in the wall. Once they accomplish this, they attempt to pull down the wall, prompting its final transformation, which highlights its active role in the scene. Liz marks the importance of this transition of the wall as a passive feature to an active participant in the imagined scene with an expanded description and using that choice diction, words like tendrils, propulsion device, emit, to take hostage reality with the color of the green-blue flame tendrils and the whirring song of the hover car, punctuated by the shrill crack as the wall transforms from a passive barrier to an active threat. From that point forward in the incident, the wall acts as shrapnel.
Verdi is flooring it. Make me a dextelligence check.
Describe it.
Dextelligence check.
Dextelligence. Oh, sorry. Dextelligence.
The average or the combination of?
Oh, that's right.
The average.
Am I supposed to roll over? Or
this is an Errol Otis trick that I learned from the family down there.
So, over?
It does a lot of this.
Over?
Yeah.
Over.
Interesting. Under.
So, under, rather.
So, like,
yeah.
Kind of quick.
Under
so
the
like
average.
Kind of quick reaction, kind of, like.
Yeah. Like, I would estimate, I mean, driving a vehicle isn't part of normal D&D.
Yes!
You got it?
Yeah,
success.
I rolled a 3.
Okay. You floor it in your hover car. You hear that, you know, like the engine brighting up, you know, the back jets on the hover car just like light up the whole clearing in kind of green blue flame tendrils. Although it's white, it's some sort of propulsion device that doesn't actually emit rocket fire or anything. It's more like a UFO. But and then the underside of the car, you know, lights up as well. You feel like the car buckle as the tether between it and the mushroom tree like pulls taut, and the inside lighting inside the car, you know, kind of like jolts on and then jolts off. You almost think you've lost the control systems for a minute. You feel the steering mechanism just kind of jerk back in
right.
your hands, but then you hear this loud screech. And, like, those of you that are outside the hover car, it's even more alarming because instead of muffled, you hear this shrill crack. And you look over at the mushroom stalk, and there's this, like, crack running up it from its base all the way to the top. A whole burst of these copper bats just kind of just fly out from under the mushroom tip as the stalk starts to collapse. In the direction of the hover car, which was on the opposite side of the wall, splintering chunks along the big amber wall start just kind of like crackling around. It sounds like you're in the middle of a fireworks display, and the fireworks are going off all around you.
So the stalk is falling towards the hover car.
Yes.
Seriously.
I did roll for the direction of the ball.
Okay, so it is heading towards the car, you said?
Yeah.
This is happening small, but like there's going to be anyone who's outside of the hover car, you're going to be attacked by a shrapnel.
What?
From that point forward in the incident, the wall acts as shrapnel. She says anyone who's caught outside the hover car, you're going to get attacked by shrapnel. So the wall has transformed from barricade to wall to shrapnel. As previously, the wall continues to project a dual nature of artifice and nature, because shrapnel implies explosive devices and intent or agency. The barricade, having become firmly fixed in the form of the wall, completes its action on the scene in an explosive and destructive burst of action. In the space of the gaming performance, when the ambiance is right and the players tuned in, things act alongside them, defining new spaces and taking reality captive in surprising ways. In this case, it meant allowing that wall to assert itself on the scene, cooperating with the group to form a world of significant events, to participate in the process of worlding. And the worlding we accomplished alongside the things was this. Milani, a Kaborn sworn to uphold the traditions of the Azure people, tried to shelter Leula, a maternal, from the wall turned shrapnel, but arrived a moment too late.
Leula.
7. Oh gosh.
Is it correct?
Oh! You're killing us!
Four
no!
4 points of damage.
Yep. That's -1.
Oh, what it looks
rest
like?
In peace. Yep.
What does it look like?
So she jumps and she's diving down to hide, and just as she goes into the dive, it like pierces through her neck. Back of her neck. And then out through the jugular.
One of the shards of
one of the shards. Blood spurt.
What does y'all's blood look like?
It's green. We have green blood and it just like.
Oh god.
That is awesome.
So, Clumsy Milani is like running and diving, and at the very end, she runs and lands on the back of Leula, right as a spray of green blood hits her in the face, and she screams out at the sky, "No! No! It should have been me!"
Literally should have been.
Like I was trying.
You
for exactly that. Yeah. We'll say that Jazul limps over to the fallen form of Leule and drops to his knees and starts singing the morning song of his people.
Okay.
Which is like a long, undulating, mostly vowels. Sounds like whale song.
We got a full.
We got whale songs?
Here we go.
Yes, canon.
Exactly.
That is canon. Oh, that is exactly
god.
What just happened.
Oh my god. Yeah, it's totally like whale sounds. Whale sounds. Woo.
Throughout the scene of Leula's death, Liz repeated the key question that drives everyone in the session. What does it look like? The aim of the campaign was to see something new through the view screen of the game, and to bring those things into the world of our experience. The next day, I asked Liz what it all meant.
It seems like a lot of times once you make a particular discovery in the context of a session, or maybe one of the players does, there's a sense in which it couldn't have been any other way.
Yeah.
There's a almost immutability to that discovery, which on one level doesn't make sense, right? Because we just made it up. But on another level, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, and that's what makes the game fun, you know, it's like brains tend are always striving to make connections between our ideas. And it's like, you know, like when you a lot of my video art stuff is based on visualization. I mean, maybe we were talking about this the other day, but when you hear music and see a moving image, your brain subconsciously tries to make all the connections it can between the two. So oftentimes there will be an abstract piece of video art that you're watching along with a piece of music, and you think that they just synced up together perfectly, you know. And or like the other day when you said that some of the soundtrack moments just kind of like hit right at the right points. And it's more of a peace and being okay with the thing that was created was because the soundtrack was where it was at that point, you know, rather than that moment coincidentally happened because of the soundtrack.
So when you experience those sort of synergistic moments like that, you know, you've talked about that the brain wants to make them happen. Do you think about them or experience them as sort of accidental outflows of how our brains evolved, or are they token of something like larger and more significant in like human existence, or both, or neither?
Well,
like, what does it mean?
It means that our existence is all about stories about our existence, you know, and it's just part of our consciousness to make up human stories, you know, because we're constantly thinking about our own lives, the decisions that we made, and how circumstances brought us to certain points in our lives. And the brain's trying to make those connections too. The reason we evolved to dream is so that our subconscious could process problems or anxieties or questions that we had during our conscious life and try to come up with, prepare itself for solutions as a survival strategy. And I think that's what our brains are doing when we play D&D. Like it's something that our subconscious mind, interacting with our conscious mind, is very used to doing. It's very natural to do it. It's why kids, you know, play and pretend. And as adults, we have to have more kind of like a structured way to play. The reason stories exist is to explore different things that could happen in your own life or that happened in other people's lives or like understand in different ways and then as a result your brain takes that information and encapsulates it and encodes it back into your experience of reality. And so stories are a way of kind of expanding your experience beyond your experience. And, so by that logic, playing D&D is like lucid dreaming in the sense that you're dreaming and you're imagining. But at the same time, you know, making all the decisions with your conscious mind. Yeah, I think that's why we play games. It's the same reason why we are evolved to dream. We're just kind of compelled to do it.
So is that connected with what you have in mind when you talk about taking reality hostage or projecting internal realities outward?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we all live in the same physical space. It's about taking over the physical. I mean, that's what theater is about. It's what performance in general is about.
As Liz suggests here, narrative is a central aspect of gaming. In the style of gaming that Liz practices in Denton, however, the story emerges from the world accessed through the game. In dreaming, even lucid dreaming, the world construction is largely unconscious. To jump immediately to the question of story is to ignore the complex middle steps of assembling a world whose events can be narrativized. In gaming, that world must be wrangled and kidnapped through the gamer's active participation with the things of the imagined world and the ambiance that conveys that world into our own. They must bind those things to the world of the gaming table through description and interaction, building a new world within our own, node by node. As the things, the players, and the ambiance cooperate to produce this new world, unexpected patternings occur. The players, looking back at the world they have helped to create, identify within it seeds of the stories that they just have to tell.